Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg around 7 o'clock right now on this day in 1888. A gentleman by the name of George Eastman would patent the film roll and register the company or the brand known as Kodak. In 1930 on this day, the Cambridge Theatre would open in London. In 1988 on this day, Mike Tyson would decide he wants to crash his silver BMW into a tree. In 1998 on this day, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire would be airing for the first time with its host as Chris Tarrant. In 1998, in the same year, on the same day, two gentlemen by the name of Larry Page and Sergey Brin would incorporate a little-known company called Google. In 2002 on this day, Kelly Clarkson would win the first ever American Idol. And in 2018 on this day, Amazon would become the second American company to hit $1 trillion status. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at Woolworths results, cash build results. We speak to both CEOs in each of those cases, try and understand how the businesses have performed and what to make of the performance. Then we speak to the JSE around the latest approvals they've gotten from the FSCA for listing requirements and the market segmentation plans they have for the JSE board. So we're going to look at that. We're going to understand what that means for you and I as investors and what it means for the markets. Then we've got a conversation with Alan Gray around the geopolitical risks that exist in frontier markets and understanding those risks. And then because it's Wednesday, we wrap things up with an executive lounge segment. We're going to be speaking to the CEO of Fortress Real Estate Investment Trust, Stephen Brown.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It wouldn't be much of a market show if we didn't start with how the markets have performed throughout the day. As usual, on a Wednesday, we're joined on the line by Sasson Wealth's David Shapiro to reflect on the market movements throughout the day. Good evening, Uncle David. Lovely to speak to you as always. I don't know what's happening in the markets. Everything just doesn't make sense. Are you seeing anything?
Absolutely not. Jimmy, on Friday evening, kind of went to bed, New York markets, or the S&P was up close to all-time highs. Everything was looking rosy, outlook positive on the back of rates that would be reduced and so on. And then you wake up, they come back after a long weekend, and all hell breaks loose, and you say, what's happened? What happened? I read all over the weekend. I always read the FT and I read the Wall Street Journal and go through everything. I picked up absolutely nothing of concern. It was almost as though they made up a lot of stories, but there you are. And I don't know how long this is going to last. I don't know what's driving it, whether there are issues that we don't really know, and there's some very strange people with computers doing a lot of damage to markets and upsetting us tremendously. So,
Uncle David, I saw that the Nikkei was down 4.5%, and we didn't really see any movement happen yesterday. But to your point around what's happening in the markets, I saw something that could potentially be the only logical explanation, is that people are getting out of positions and deciding to sit on the sidelines. So they're doing exactly what Warren Buffett did and selling out of positions and saying, we want to wait for interest rate cuts to actually happen and for September to be done before we get back in the markets. Yeah. Is that a plausible thing to be considering at this point?
I don't know. Why would one want to do that? There's nothing. Why I say that, there's nothing in the valuations, or there's nothing in many of the stocks that we follow that are really concerning. I'm not a believer that the tech industry is grossly overvalued and that AI is nothing more than a fad and is not going to deliver. It doesn't come through from the people in the industry. If you talk to analysts who look at that, who look very closely, most of them are incredibly positive. Companies themselves are positive what can happen. It's too early to say no. It's too early to say that this is not going to happen. We don't know. So I think there's an enormous amount of trading around this. There's so many. Today, markets are made up largely of professional traders. They call themselves hedge funds, but that's nothing more than a nice name for trading funds. People who take big bets, some are calculated, they might have computer programs that give kind of hints. But there's not you and me, you know, just go and buy 100 shares here and there and say we're going to put it in our portfolios and we're going to wait for the long term. So I think a lot of movement in cash and positioning is settling market. At the end of the day, it'll all sort itself out. You know, it'll all eventually the earnings do make sense, you know, and will determine where share prices settle.
What do we do in the meantime? What do we do while the market is going through these erratic periods of volatility as average investors that don't really, as you say, that don't really have enough to move the needle? Do we sit on the sidelines?
No, you take advantage of some of the prices that they're not. You know, Jimmy, I like Nvidia, but I'm not obsessive about stocks. And I don't get too emotional. But this morning I've fallen. I went on to about 50, 60 different analysts who cover the stock. And, you know, names among them, a lot of names I don't know. But it's widely followed. And I looked for fear. I said, is there anything there that they're saying? And there wasn't one cell amongst all of those. One or two people, you know, one or two analysts who had a hold. But by and large, the view was very positive, you know, with the target price of about 148, you know, from where it is now down 100. That's a nice return. So, you know, looking at it, I'm saying, okay, so why is the market marking it down if this is what analysts are telling their clients? So I can't reconcile that. And I think applying the same thing to shares like ASML, to all the big tech companies, there's very little negative news amongst the, you know, amongst analysts. So, you know, that's what puzzles me. If that makes sense, I'm saying I would take advantage of some of these stocks now at these very low levels.
Would that include PGM stocks? Because the likes of Northam and Implats have those have not been having a good time.
No, that's funny enough. I had to write for the FM. I was asked to say you're positive and you're negative. And the one positive I had was ASML, and on the negative side that worried me. And that's because Neil Froneman, I think when Sibanye's results came out, he gave a very dreary outlook for palladium, you know, which is a bit scary. Doesn't see any major increase in the next couple of years. And I think the reason is, of course, that you know, people are switching to platinum for catalysts. And the other point is that the demand is starting, you know, it's falling because people are switching to electric vehicles. So I don't think downsides much. That's why I think we're at the kind of in bottom area. But it does curtail the upside. But still, you know, you can take, I think if you are going to take a bet, if you really want to make big money and you're prepared to wait, I think probably that is the segment of the market that offers that. But that's Hollywood bets, you know. That's what, you know what I mean?
That's a Hollywood bets move, but it does require some patience. Michael David, before I let you go, your thoughts on the Rand at the moment, still hovering below that 18 Rand level. We saw a big push towards 1750. We didn't really get there or hold below there. How are we feeling about it? Are we waiting for rate cuts?
We are. You know, we wait. I think when America cuts rates, probably the Rand will be a bit of a kicker, but then as we reduce rates and other countries reduce rate, I think it's going to kind of stabilize. So it's we're probably close to the best levels we're going to see. I reckon 750.
I think we've just lost Uncle David there. We did have a bit of a patchy line towards him, but we do appreciate the time and the insights that he's put in to sharing with us. That's David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth on the market movements today, the things to stay away from and the things to get into.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As geopolitical relationships shift and tensions rise around the world, investors seeking opportunities beyond our shores need to be mindful of a range of new risks. Join the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray's Rory Kutiska Jacobson explains the risks and how they're shaping the opportunity set. He'll delve into the Russia-Ukraine war and its impact on the investment outlook for neighboring countries. Brought to you by Alan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're thick of it into the results, and today's Woolies gave us their results as well. The Woolworths CEO Roy Bagatini caught up with our editor at Moneyweb, Break for Nikar, to discuss those numbers and discuss the performance of Woolworths over the last year. Let's listen in on that conversation.
Retail group Woolworths reported financial results for its financial year to the end of June today. Revenues rose by 4% to 77 billion rand. The adjusted headline earnings dropped by 26% to 3.5 billion rand, and the board declared a final dividend of 1.17 rand a share, which means the total dividend for the year is 2.65 rand a share. Roy Bagatini is on the line. He's the chief executive. Roy, thank you so much for your time. I must first congratulate you on the detailed financial report you produced and published today. It's really one of the most detailed I've seen in a while. But it shows that it has been a tough year for Woolies, both in South Africa and Australasia.
Yes, no, thank you, Ray. And on the point of detail, I mean, I think we like being very candid and transparent. And to the extent that we can share what we can, we do, because it's important, particularly for investors, to understand our company as well as they can. And we try and help that. But yes, it has been a disappointing year for us. And the group bottom line, when you look at it, was largely due to macro factors, particularly in Australia, where we've had and we've seen the double-digit decline in footfall or traffic into the malls and stores. And the Country Road Group in particular was heavily impacted by that. And in turn, that has heavily impacted our business. But we are a portfolio of business, fortunately, and there is benefit in the fact of having a portfolio. On the other hand, we've seen our food business perform exceptionally well. You know, it was just last year that the Country Road Group, in fact, did contribute the most to our earnings growth. This year, it's had a moment in time, and it hasn't actually done so. But a lot of it, as I say, attributable to what we see happening macro-contextually there.
The South African business focus on the higher end of the consumer spectrum. And Checkers, for example, is moving into that space as well. Are you concerned about that move from them?
I think they've been trying to move into that space for some time. And obviously, we're aware of their intent, their strategies, you know, upgrading their stores, trying to improve whatever it is they do from a product offering perspective. When you are the leader in anything, you typically do have a target on your back, and they've been coming after us for some time. But I think we're actually very confident in our overall proposition. You know, I think we do have, and I don't say this with any arrogance whatsoever, but I think we do have the best proposition for customers in the market. We are the most innovative. Our product quality is significantly superior, and it's all underpinned by the great things that we do at the back end. All the sustainability, our cold chain, which is very difficult to replicate by competitors, our supplier partnerships, our exclusivity arrangements with them and how they work with us. These are things that are not easy to replicate by competitors. And then you go into our store environment. Our service, our experience for customers is a notch or two above. And a lot of the surveys and the research that is conducted and that we do continually tell us that. But we cannot rest on our laurels, and we're continually moving forward. I mean, one of the things we've shared this morning in our presentation is our next generation store, which is really taking food retailing to the next level. So it's about how we reconfigure what we do in the store, putting the kitchen at the heart of it and moving bakery around and making coffee more accessible, etc. So we're very well aware of the space that our competitors are coming after, but we also compare ourselves to what they do. And if you look at our like-for-like sales, we are still the strongest in the sector by some way. And in addition to that, if you look at how we convert sales into profit, our competitors are left standing still, as far as I'm concerned.
Tell us a bit more about this next generation store.
It's a very exciting concept. What we've done is we've obviously researched globally and locally to see what we can do to improve the overall customer experience of shopping our product in our store. We're also looking for ways to bring up the work we do in the back end, our supply chain, into our stores, because it's all underpinned by the sustainability work we do. So we've reset the format of the store, the configuration of the store. So everything that you typically see when you walk into a Woolies store that happens at the back of the store, we're now sort of concentrating in the center of a store. And it's really the theater of the store where all of the kitchen, the deli counters and so on, everything that goes on there, you'll see happening. And it really is the heartbeat of the store. We're also moving the bakery to the front of the store. We know that when customers walk into a store and they smell the bakery, it really sort of lifts their mood and gets them into a different mindset when they sort of then start walking through our aisles and seeing all of what it is we have on offer. We're also wanting to make coffee much more accessible because we know customers like having a cup of coffee when they shop our stores. But the intent here is really raising the bar in premium food retailing. And just again, just keeping that step or two ahead of our competitors. Our customers are responding exceptionally well. We've got six of these now that we've laid out already. And obviously the trading densities, the way we measure our sales performance, has also improved quite significantly. So we're very pleased with that initiative.
So what is the rollout schedule for this new concept?
Yes, it's underway. So anything we do new from here onward out represents all of that. And then we're also rolling back because obviously we have 350 stores. So we're actually rolling back into those stores. And the neat thing about this next gen or the store of the future format, it has a number of concepts. So you can either roll out the entire store, you can roll out certain concepts. And so we're beginning to look back at stores that have already opened or that were already trading and then sort of inserting some of these new concepts into those stores. So it's an ongoing program. You'll know we've actually going to be investing about 10 billion rand in our business over the next couple of years. And a big part of this is obviously changing and upgrading the customer experience through this new store of the future option.
Are you expanding your store network?
Yes, we are very circumspect about how we go after space. We're not on a land grab. We don't have to open a store on every corner. That's not our strategy. I mean, what is important, though, is when you look at our existing stores, what we call trading density, you know, we get about 160,000 rand per square meter on average out of our store. Some stores trade up to 300,000 square meters on average. So clearly the store is too small for the trading opportunity. So expanding those stores is our first priority, number one. Secondly, we are going into this refurbishment model and redoing a number of our stores as we look back at the stores that are trading. And thirdly, we have a number of newer formats in what we call the food services space, cafes, coffee carts. We've got W Cellar, our liquor proposition, our alcohol beverage sales proposition. And these are all incremental space opportunities. But what's very important for us is that the space we open and the sales we get from that must convert to profit. That's our metric. It's got to be profitable sales. It's not just space for the sake of it and scale for the sake of it. So to answer your question very specifically, there's going to be a number of new big food retail stores as we currently have them, 22, in fact, in the next year. But most of the space opportunity will come from some of these adjacent categories that I've just described.
And what are your plans for the fashion and beauty division?
We are very pleased with the progress we're making with turning that business around. We're seeing all the key financial metrics, what we call the underlying financial health of the business, those metrics delivering for us. We weren't happy with the top line performance this year, somewhat impacted by the context, the macros, but to some extent, we're just not executing as well as I would like us to. So we're putting quite a lot of focus on that, in particular product availability, making sure the product's in the store when the customer wants it. Big focus for us. But notwithstanding within that, we continue to make really good progress in setting this business up and making big investments behind it so that it can deliver what customers expect from it. But within the fashion, beauty and home area, we've also got beauty. And that's a big play for us, right? We're looking at expanding our beauty business, doubling it, in fact, over the next couple of years. We've already doubled it in the last few years. And we are really becoming fast the shopping destination for beauty in the country, which we're very, very pleased about.
And just lastly, we are seeing really adverse weather patterns in South Africa. And a question somebody close to me asked me a while back is, does that impact the sale of clothing at the big retailers, especially if it's prolonged cold periods or very hot periods? Does that have an impact?
I mean, clothing is typically a seasonal business. So if you sell out of your winter clothes before the summer comes, you're going to have a challenge. Or if you sell out of your summer before winter arrives, or if winter arrives too late and you've got all of your winter product in the store, you do have an impact. So seasonality is tracked very, very closely. And we try and buy product and flow product into the store to coincide where we think seasonality will be. But your point is actually a really good one, because there is a lot of more volatility in what we're seeing from a demand perspective. So it's critical that we have sort of an inventory management model that allows us to move product to where the demand is. Historically, Woolies basically bought product and shipped it out to the stores. And so if you had a hot season somewhere in the country in the north, and you sold out of all your summer stuff there, but it was cold in the Cape, you couldn't really move your product from the Cape to the north efficiently. Now we're actually starting to sort of centralize a lot of our product distribution so we can respond to customer demand where it is. and deal with some of these big volatile and variances in weather patterns a lot more effectively.
I think the north had a very warm winter and the Cape a very cold one.
Yes, and an extended one too, yeah.
Roy, thank you so much for your time. That was Roy Bagattini, the chief executive of Woolworths.
As your family tree grows, so should your investments. From creating a safety net for your family to planning for grandchildren, we have the investment solution for you. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP. You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We got more company results today, and we got results from the Cashbuild family. Cashbuild gave us their full year results for the year ended 30 June 2024. I'm joined on the line by Cashbuild's CEO, Werner Diacher, to take a look at the numbers and try and make sense of them. Good evening, Werner. Lovely to speak to you again. Revenues up 5%, dividend down almost 30%. How do you reflect on the period?
Good evening, Jimmy. It was a difficult period for the business. It's never pleasant when your bottom line is down, but unfortunately, in tough conditions, we're prepared to give away a bit of gross margin and keep our customers in store and keep them happy. But yeah, with expense base growing as well, that related to bottom line, that was down. And unfortunately, dividend following suit in terms of our 66% payout ratio that we're maintaining.
Werner, take me through some of those movements throughout the year. Obviously, some of the challenges you could not have foreseen coming. How did the business kind of fare, and where did you really see the struggle come in?
Jim, I think it's one very simple thing. Consumers, it's all under pressure. And you know, we've seen it, especially in the first three quarters of the financial year for us, decorative products performing better than structural items, and which is an indication people are not adding rooms or building new things, but they're just renovating or doing flooring or painting or doing something smaller projects, if I can say that. So in quarter four, that changed. Luckily, we've seen a much better performance from the structural products in the business as well. So that was an interesting shift that happened.
Werner, would you say you've kind of seen a mellowing out of demand from the construction space when compared to COVID periods, for example, where everybody kind of had a big drive to make those renovations and everybody was under lockdown and didn't have much else to do? How's the business faring now? I know it's a couple of years post-COVID, but are you seeing any kinds of patterns from the COVID period that have carried through?
Not really. The post-COVID period was just a very free-for-all period in terms of everybody was doing something at home and changing things. And so we haven't seen that. We follow a pattern normally is that the structural items do well and that then gets followed by the finishing products. And the fact that we've seen structural doing slightly better is good news for us. But other than that, there's not really a trend. Obviously, things like the two-pot system and potential rate cuts should also be positive in terms of consumers having more money to spend in the stores.
Werner, let's look at the Zakhele Khaya initiative that you guys have within the business. That's certainly something that you guys have been busy with for quite some time to get that off the ground, to make sure you're able to provide that affordable housing solution. Take me through that project and where it kind of fits into the business model now, understanding that people do still need to continuously build homes.
Yeah, it's been a few years in the making. What we're trying to do is to help address the affordable housing shortage in South Africa. And we've partnered with the National Housing Finance Corporation and sort of helping customers, facilitating it basically for them to apply for that first-time homeowner grant that they can get from the NHFC. And further to that, we've done some architect drawing house plans that's pre-costed, that's available in store to purchase. And then our partners in providing finance, the likes of Capitec, provides a top-up finance so that we can make that dream come true for people to put a quality home over their roofs.
Werner, when we go back to the numbers and we just look through some of the details within the numbers, I saw that the business did go through some impairments, but the impairments are obviously accounting adjustments that you kind of have to go through. Take me through some of those movements and how that's affected the operational expenses of the business.
Yeah, so the impairment, we again unfortunately had to impair the rest of the P&L trademark and goodwill. And that had a 137 million impact on the current year. So when you look at operating expenses on the face of the income statement, it's been up 5%. If you exclude those two out of it, it's actually grown by 6%. But it's luckily now fully impaired, so we're not expecting anything, or there won't be any more tradewill and goodwill impairments from P&L coming.
Mm. What can we look forward to, Werner? Going into the new year, obviously, it's kind of something that the team needs to build forward on, understanding that you have to put whatever last year's performance was to bed, put it behind you and move forward to continue growing the business. Are you guys looking at opening new stores? Is there something from a strategy point of view where you're saying we might be able to go into this area whilst our core business is a little soft?
Indeed, we've managed for the first time in a couple of years to actually add net numbers to our store base from 318 up to 322. And we've seen very good success with our alternative model store, or as we call it, our small model stores. That's given us opportunity to go into pre-existing buildings and help us grow the store numbers. And we're planning to do at least 10 of them in the year coming. So from a strategy perspective, that's a slight change in terms of our traditional model that we've been trading through. But it's been very successful, and we hope that it'll give us the bit of an impetus on adding store numbers.
Mm. Werner, how are you feeling about the state of the South African consumer? I mean, your business is quite consumer driven, and as you touched on, the interest rate impact and just consumer pressure is definitely weighing on your business. How are you kind of feeling at the moment, understanding that we still don't have a guarantee of those rate cuts, but we're hopeful?
Yes, no, it is. The consumers are under pressure. We can see it in the way they react and what they buy. But we are quietly positive about the aspects or the prospects of a rate cut, and linked to the fact that we believe that the government of national unity will do a bit more on infrastructure spend that's long overdue, which will employ more people and give money to be spent in stores. And then, as I mentioned just now, that the two-pot system, we should hopefully see some benefit from that coming into the business as well. Hopefully people will spend that pension money on durable goods.
Well, we wish you the best of luck in the new financial year. Hopefully the green shoots start to come through and the pressure is eased. I think we'll catch up when the next set of numbers come out, or before that if you decide to buy anything. But we'll leave it at that for now, Werner. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Werner De Jager, CEO at Cashbuild, on the year that was for them and what they might be looking at in the new year to keep the business going.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So yesterday, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA, approved the JSE's listing requirements that specifically deal with market segmentation. These requirements will come into effect later this month, but we're going to take a look at them now and understand what it means for you and I as consumers and as investors. And I'm joined on the line by Andre Fisser, who is a director for issuer regulation at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Andre. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the changes. What are the changes, and take us through what they mean?
Good afternoon, Jimmy. Thank you for the opportunity. Yes, I think the announcement that we published yesterday brings into effect the JSE's market segmentation initiative. And it's basically an attempt by the JSE to reposition the JSE's main board into two distinct sections. It'll be the prime segment and the general segment. And if you look at what we are proposing, it is to provide a more fit-for-purpose regulatory model for the general segment, which is aimed at the smaller companies that are listed on the main board. So when these requirements come into effect on the 23rd of September, those companies that would be eligible to apply would then be able to comply with a different set of regulations that will provide far greater flexibility, significant cost savings, and very importantly, creating an environment that's far more enabling to allow these companies to raise capital.
Andre, when we look at the implications of these changes, what does that then mean for investors? Are they going to now see two different JSEs? Is that going to affect the user experience? How does that change look like from an investor point of view?
So, Jimmy, it wouldn't change the investor experience. The cornerstone of this model is still full transparency and disclosure. We believe it's essential that we create the right sort of balance in terms of looking at the interest of issuers, but also ensuring that investors have sufficient information to make informed decisions. So we don't think investors' experience would change as a result of this, but they would get the indirect benefits where companies will be able to operate in a more flexible environment. And obviously the cost savings is an important element. It's perhaps just worth mentioning, Jimmy, that this is not unique to the JSE. There are many other international markets that also have a tiered model for their main board. And I think this is our attempt to provide a more flexible environment for those smaller companies that are listed on the main board.
Will the smaller companies have different requirements to have to meet in terms of listing on the smaller or the mini JSE, so to speak?
So, Jimmy, I think the important thing to mention is the JSE operates the main board, which is for more established companies with a three-year track record, with certain profit requirements that they have to meet. And then we have the alternative exchange, which is for small startup companies. Now, in respect of the general segment, it's for the main board. So the entry criteria to get onto the main board will remain identical for both the general and the prime segment. So it's still focused on established companies. Where the benefit comes in is once they are listed, they will be exposed to a far more flexible environment. And as I said earlier, faced with lots of cost savings that comes as a result of that.
Andre, when we look at that general segment around the main board, so you'll have the prime segment and we'll have the general segment. What are some of the strategic advantages potentially that a smaller company might benefit from? You touched on the cost-saving side of it, but are there any other advantages around perhaps capital raising measures or visibility on the general segment that would then come into effect now that you kind of have the approval to split the segments?
Yeah, Jimmy, we obviously announced a raft of different proposals, but a capital raising was obviously one of the main issues. And what we wanted to make sure is something, and very often we see that some of these smaller companies on the main board do struggle to raise capital. So from a JSE perspective, we reflected on that and said, what is it that we can do to make that environment as enabling as possible? And one of the main proposals that will be coming to effect on the 23rd of September is that companies will be able to raise capital in the form of an issue of shares for cash without convening a meeting of shareholders, provided it's operated and done within certain limitations, pricing limitations and quantum, the number of shares. But that will certainly put companies in a far better position to raise capital much more efficiently, quicker, and with far lower costs. So enabling environment for capital raising was front and center for us, and that is one of the main proposals that was announced as part of market segmentation.
Andre, this isn't the first innovation that the JSE has put in place in recent times. I remember having a conversation with Valdine Reddy around the partnership or the relationship and integration with the Saudi exchange, the Tata Wool exchange, from that perspective. That's now come online as well. But in addition to that, Euronext has come online. Take me through those developments as well and what they mean for expanding the offering that the JSE is able to bring to market.
Yeah, Jimmy, I think the main objective that we have from a JSE perspective is to provide investors with choice and with alternatives. And in addition to providing them with exposure to South African companies, we think it's important to allow investors to also invest in foreign companies that list and trade on the JSE. It settles in rands, it trades in rands. So if you look at our secondary listings framework, we've got a list of approved and accredited exchanges that where companies that are listed on those exchanges can apply for an inward secondary listing onto the JSE. It's a very select list of exchanges because obviously we want to make sure that the framework is acceptable to us. And what we announced as part of the market segmentation project, we also announced to the market that we're expanding that list to include exchanges like Tata Wool and then also the balance of the exchanges within the Euronext stable. And the reason why I refer to the balance is because Euronext Amsterdam and Euronext Brussels is already on our list of approved exchanges. And we've now expanded that to include Paris, Dublin, Milan, Lisbon, and Oslo as well.
Andre, where to from here for the JSE? We've clearly seen that the innovation drive is front and center. And I remember having a conversation with Dr. Leila Faree around the efforts to continue to lead the continent in terms of innovation, in terms of integration, and in terms of offering. Where to from here for the JSE, and what can we look forward to?
So, Jimmy, to take you back to a consultation document that we published in 2022, we highlighted a number of key initiatives in that document. Market segmentation was one of them, and that's now come to a conclusion. Another significant project that we announced in 2022 was what we refer to as the simplification project, and that is basically aimed at simplifying the listings requirements. Now, for the listeners, just to give you a sense, the listing requirements is a set of detailed rules that's applicable to listed companies that they must comply with. And at this point in time, it consists of about between 700 and 800 pages of detailed listings requirements. And there has been concerns in the market that the rules are, in certain cases, too onerous. And the simplification project will aim, the main aim of the simplification project would be to simplify the listings requirements and put it into plain language, remove red tape, to make it easier for issuers to comply and easier for investors to understand. So that's another significant project from a regulatory point of view. And I would say probably the biggest regulatory change that we've proposed probably in the last 2 to 3 decades.
Mm. Certainly some innovative changes being brought about by the leading stock exchange on the African continent. We love to see it, and we hope to see it continue. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights, Andre. That's Andre Visser, Director of Issuer Regulation at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, joining me to reflect on the latest approval granted by the FSCA to the JSE around adjusting listing requirements and creating somewhat of a new segment on the JSE.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Allan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. And we're taking a look at some global developments. We understand, obviously, that with the world that we live in, things that happen around the world tend to have an impact on local developments. I'm joined on the line by Allan Gray's portfolio manager, Rory Kutiska-Jacobson, to take a look at some global news. Good evening, Rory. Lovely to speak to you again. It's been quite a while. Let's look at where we stand globally. I think it's a good starting point for our conversation. A lot has been happening in the last couple of months, but a lot is still to come before the end of the year.
Hi, good evening, Jimmy. You're absolutely right. A lot has happened, and I guess what's unusual about this year is an unprecedented number of countries going to election at the same time. So I think this is the largest year in terms of the number of countries and the percentage of the global population voting in some form of a democratic election this year. And the other interesting thing is, I guess, we've seen, unfortunately, almost a polarization in views across a number of markets, where the moderate middle has almost disappeared and the choices presented to democracies are very much kind of skewing increasingly so towards the far left or the far right.
Mm. Rory, when we look at these global developments, obviously there are different markets and different markets kind of play a different role or have a different impact on developments. So, for example, something that's happening in the US might have a stronger impact on global markets than something perhaps happening in Russia. Well, Russia's a bad example because that's going through quite a bit. But when we look at all of these geopolitical events and what's happening in the world, investing becomes harder because something that happens in Russia or in the Russia-Ukraine war can be easily affected by something else around the world on the opposite end. How do we understand that? How do we understand the dynamics of the inter-global play?
It's not easy, and I would say it's not getting easier. So I think geopolitical tension has certainly escalated over the last 5 or 10 years. And if you look at kind of the rhetoric coming out of the US, what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, the rhetoric coming out of China, it's likely to increase. What I find very interesting, though, I mean, and I look at this probably through the lens of emerging markets or frontier markets, is often there's an impact from an investment perspective in two ways. One is the impact on sentiment. So, you know, when geopolitical tension is heightened, is it a positive or negative impact on sentiment? And then also the impact on the economy. And what I find interesting is often the two don't go hand in hand. So there can be situations where impact on sentiment is negative, but the actual impact on the underlying economy can be quite positive. And I think a great example is if you look at, I guess you mentioned it, but if you look at what happened in Russia and Ukraine, immediately after Russia invaded Ukraine, it obviously had a hugely negative sentiment on Russian equities and Ukrainian equities, but it also had a massively negative impact on a number of other Eastern European and kind of Eurasian stocks that border those two countries. And so a great example is a country like Georgia, just south of Russia. It shares a border with Russia. The large kind of shares in Georgia sold off materially when that happened. And I think people were obviously concerned about the knock-on impact that the war might have on that economy. Funnily enough, what actually happened in Georgia is a huge number of Ukrainians and Russians relocated to Georgia to escape the war. And a lot of trade was redirected out of those two economies into Georgia. And Georgia, being quite a small economy, actually disproportionately benefited from that. So not that you ever want to be a benefactor of war, but here was a situation where the shares sold off sharply, but the underlying economy actually did very well over the subsequent 2.5 years.
It sounds like this creates a lot more risk. When we look at geopolitical events and global events, I'm hearing that risk becomes that much more important. How do we balance that risk, especially when we think about portfolios and striking a good portfolio balance? So I have a portfolio that's international, or I have a portfolio that's locally based. How do I then review that and say the risk that is sitting outside of my country could potentially weigh in on my own portfolio, and what decisions do I make when I pick stocks?
That's a good question. And I think the one thing I want to stress is when it comes to investing, you cannot avoid risk. And so I guess the more pertinent question is, am I being adequately compensated for the risks that I'm taking by a sufficiently discounted price? And I think that's really important. That's what people often miss out on. So we actually almost look to often capitalize on some of these events where sentiment turns extremely negative because there's a risk that's now front and center in someone's mind. What often tends to happen is people then get very negative on that market or the one or two particular stocks, and they get sold off aggressively. And often you can then find kind of real bargains where even if that risk materializes, the price is sold off so sharply that you've been more than compensated for taking that risk. And if for whatever reason it's slightly better than what people are pricing in, then you can do extremely well.
Rory, when we look at something like that from a risk and a payoff point of view, I had a conversation a little earlier on with David Shapiro, and he wasn't too keen on something like the platinum counters that we have in South Africa, obviously with all the geopolitical conversations happening around the PGM and EV space. Is that one of those situations where if you haven't been badly burnt up to this point, you could take on a minimal portion of risk for a potentially bigger output in the long term?
Yes. I mean, the one, I guess, longer-term issue with platinum group metals is there's a lot of uncertainty with respect to long-term demand and the speed at which electric vehicles might displace internal combustion engines. And historically, these have been very cyclical businesses, kind of swinging from bouts of making super profits to something more like the current environment where they're either break-even or loss-making. If history is any guide, the time to be buying platinum group metal companies are when earnings are depressed, when the PGM basket is depressed. So very similar to the current environment. So, I mean, certainly from our perspective, we're seeing quite a lot more value in the PGM space than we saw a year ago or 18 months ago, and we have started actually nibbling at one or two of the names.
Rory, before I let you go, I want to look at the risk not from a market point of view, but from perhaps a region point of view. When we look at emerging markets, or we look at frontier markets, or we look at developed markets, there's obviously different levels of risk to price in, and there's a different level of risk to price into a market like the United States at the moment. Which markets at the moment are you finding that the risk kind of makes a lot of sense? And I think about South Africa as an example in that case, where we've gone through an election rather peacefully, and other countries still have to go through an election that might create more volatility.
So actually, I mean, if you ask me, I'm not going to exactly answer your question. The market, I think, if the risk isn't being adequately priced, which people probably don't appreciate that the risk isn't being fully priced, I would say is the USA. So, you know, if I'm an outsider and I look at the two candidates being put forward as potential president, I don't find either one particularly appealing. And if I look at kind of the tension in the U.S. democratic system, it's much more divisive than it has been for some time. And yet, U.S. stocks are trading at record highs, where in contrast, a number of emerging markets, you know, have gone nowhere or down in dollar terms over the last decade. And people tend to focus far more on the geopolitical risk than the underlying quality of businesses and the price you're paying.
Very interesting perspective, especially on the US. I love to hear it, but we have run out of time. I think we'll have to leave the conversation there. Rory, we'll catch up again another time. Thanks so much for the insights. That's Rory Kutiska-Jacobson, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray, on understanding geopolitical risks and how they could potentially affect your investment decisions. This segment was brought to you by Allan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Another Wednesday, another executive to get to know a little bit better. This week's executive is the Chief Executive Officer at Fortress Real Estate Investment Trust. That is Stephen Brown. He joins me now to get a little bit of a better idea of what he does and what he enjoys doing when he's not running a business. Good evening, Stephen. Thanks so much for taking the time. You've been in the property space for quite some time, even before your days at Fortress. Why property?
I guess I actually left school with, I guess, not that much direction. I started in finance, and I decided to do the accounting stream at UCT, largely because a friend of mine towards the end of school was also doing it, and I followed his advice. And then we did finance and accounting. Ended up at KPMG. And then after that, I went traveling for a bit. And then I was looking for a job. And a fund manager who ran a property unit trust at Stanlib was starting her own unit trust actually inside Coronation Capital. And she needed an analyst. And I had some financial skills. I was a chartered financial analyst at that stage. And yeah, I became a listed property analyst. And that's how I actually got into the industry.
Any regrets? Do you wish you had gone into a different sector, or are you quite happy where you are?
I guess I wish I'd gone into AI and then I could have retired early, but no regrets. I love property. And I think, you know, the thing that I find really attractive about it is that it's always relevant to everyone. Everybody lives in a flat, in a house. We work often in offices or at a study at home. And, you know, I mentioned AI, and even those little bits of data need a place to live, and that's in a data center, which needs a real estate component. So, you know, I think real estate touches every little piece of business. And I think that's what I find so appealing, because it is always going to be around. As long as humans are around, we'll need a space to exist and to live and be entertained. So I like it. It exposes you to lots of different sectors of the economy, and there's always some interest that I think people pay to real estate, because we've got such a connection to it.
Mm. Stephen, what do you get up to in a typical day? What does a day in your life look like?
Sure. Generally, I wake up and try and get a bit of exercise in. And then, you know, we work in the office, so we actually never had a work from home policy. So I kind of, you know, do some of my parental duties in terms of taking the kids to school now and then, and then we try and get into the office quite early. So usually sort of between 7:30 we're all in the office, and then I try and have as few meetings as is possible, and that is a big challenge. But I like to just potter around the office and have the conversations with the staff and really kind of see what's happening at the coalface of our business.
Stephen, when you step out of the office, how do you let go? How do you unwind? How do you forget about the day that was and focus on other things?
Yeah, I guess that always becomes quite quite difficult to do, to forget about work completely. But, you know, fortunately, decided many years ago to get involved in sponsoring golf. So I think that's been always a good thing for us to try and get involved in. So we try and get a little bit of golf, you know, as and when we can. Sometimes on the weekends, I'll go and play with my son. That's sort of something that I try and do. But, you know, being a parent, I think you end up on the side of the sports field on the weekends, probably more often than many of us would like. But, you know, it's not forever. So I often go and watch my son play sport or my daughter play sport on the weekends, and then in the evenings try and spend as much time as I can with them.
Family time sounds very, very important. Does the family enjoy traveling, Stephen?
They certainly do. They certainly do. And I think we're quite fortunate to, you know, we've got an associate in Amsterdam. So I travel there quite often, and I took them with me not so long ago. So they do really enjoy the traveling and seeing new places. You know, I think it's also quite fortunate myself to spend some time in Eastern Europe, which is a slightly unusual destination for some. It's not really run of the mill in terms of, you know, places that people would put on their bucket list to visit. But I must say, some of the most beautiful cities in Poland, Romania, and Central Europe, you know, a place like Budapest, I went there for work, and my wife joined me, and she was absolutely blown away by Budapest in Central Europe. And I really, you know, I think often recommend to my friends and people who ask me that they should try out some of those Eastern European cities for slightly less run-of-the-mill tourism, but just as much beauty as, you know, the likes of Paris.
Mm. Stephen, you mentioned getting in a workout in whenever you can. Do you have a preferred kind of sport or hobby that you engage in when you're not thinking about all the work?
Yeah, I try and run a little bit. So we have a small running group that goes out twice a week. But, you know, as the years progress, so the pace gets slower. I think the conversations get more repetitive, but it's always just as enjoyable. yeah, and then every now and then I try and do a short triathlon if I can, but, you know, certainly nothing close to competitive. I think, you know, the problem with corporates and with corporates where you've got offshore operations is often you're traveling, and the easiest thing to pack is your running shoes, and you can just pop them on and go for a run in the morning. You know, whereas you can't exactly travel around with a road bike or a mountain bike as easily. So I quite like to run as much as I can.
Stephen, red or white wine? Or any?
Definitely white, Jimmy. Definitely white. No, I like a good red, but if you're going to put a gun to my head and make me choose, I'll definitely choose a nice dry white wine.
Favorite meal?
Definitely something fresh. Involving, I think, fish, but you know, our managing director, you know, he is also a dad, and I guess he can tell dad jokes, but you know, he says he has a seafood diet. Everything he sees, he eats. A little bit the same. I have no preferences, but I do like to have a nice fresh piece of fish or some pasta, something along those lines.
Stephen, what's the one thing your team doesn't know about you that you might not want them to know either, but you're going to tell them now?
Well, now I guess I'm on the spot to have to tell them. You know, I actually am, I think, a very shy person, and maybe they don't realize that about me, but, you know, I've always been shy, and I actually struggle to be in the spotlight, which I guess a role that I'm in now. Maybe it doesn't seem like it, but, you know, it's you get used to it, but it's something that's never come naturally to me to be a bit more in the public eye and doing results presentations, because I'm inherently actually quite a shy person who's naturally quite quiet, and I've had to you know, develop those skills to stand up and be a bit more in the public eye and a little bit more front and center for the business. But it doesn't really accord with my natural instincts or my personality, to be honest.
That's quite interesting. That's very surprising.
Maybe they do know that about me, and you know, they'll say, yes, we completely understand that, and we know that about you. Maybe that'll be the response, but you know, all depends how well I'm doing in the role.
That's quite interesting. That's quite a interesting revelation to learn. And I think we'll leave it on that, actually. Stephen Brown, the shy CEO who enjoys seafood, especially if he can see the food that he wants to eat. Thanks so much, Stephen, for the time and for the insights. That's Stephen Brown, CEO at Fortress, joining me for this week's Executive Lounge and sharing a bit more about his life. We've come to the end of the show. Greg Hoss is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the latest round of sports from the top sport team. From my side, good night.